Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
To me, this is all about demonstrating that, in this case, Muhammad is a powerful man. That's baked into the regulations. The FIA has all the power it needs. It doesn't need to throw its weight around. We can go into the room and say, hey, guys, look, I know at the karting track, the first word of English that you learned was the F-bomb. I get that. You were all 12 at the time. But we need you to be more respectful in, an organized press conference. We don't want to take the emotion out of the sport. If we treat them with respect, they will respond. I've seen it personally. I know it. And I trust these drivers to do the right thing.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast, brought to you by Autosport. This week, we meet one of the most powerful women in F1 and an American who plans to be one of the most powerful men in the sport next year. As Chief Commercial Officer of F1 and CEO of the Las Vegas Grand Prix, Emily Prazer is responsible for bringing billions of dollars of revenue into the sport. She tells us her plans to make Vegas bigger and better this year, but more inclusive for fans of all budgets, and reveals the economic impact of the Grand Prix. Meanwhile, Tim Mayer will face off against Mohammed Ben Sulayem in December's election for FIA president. He faces an uphill task, but he strongly believes the FIA can be more professionally run. He explains why he's decided to run, what he would do differently from the current president, and how he would avoid conflicts with F1 drivers over topics like jewellery and swearing. I'm joined in the studio today by Autosport's F1 business correspondent, Mark Manbryans. Mark, good to see you.
And you, James. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, close to 500,000 people were at Silverstone over 4 days, 168,000 on race day, and it really felt like it. F1 the movie, meanwhile, has made nearly $300 million at the box office already after 2 weekends. Mark, it seems F1 is booming.
Yes, absolutely. And Silverstone just kind of summed it up, didn't it? It was a great race to have just after that boom of the F1 movies you mentioned there, not only because it was Silverstone, the 75th anniversary, things like that, but also because of the racing we actually saw on track as well. It kind of maybe drew some parallels to those, slightly weird and wacky things that we saw in the F1 movie. We saw some of them on the track, actually, at Silverstone, didn't we? So, yeah, I think it was a perfect time for that kind of race. It's a perfect time for Formula One, even if you look at, Lego trophies on the podium. There's different things happening in F1 across all different assets of it at the moment.
Well, between 2019 and 2024, Liberty Media says F1 series annual sponsorship revenue more than doubled to $636 million. At a team level, total sponsorship now revenue increased by 60% to $1.3 billion over the same period, according to Nielsen. So it seems like, yes, it's growing in terms of fans, Mark, but actually what this is doing is attracting sponsor dollars, a lot of them coming from the US, quite a lot of them tech firms, B2B brands, but also increasingly seeing consumer brands coming in.
Yeah, it's not rocket science, James, is it? If you know, and there are numbers that are available that show there are this X amount of eyes now tuned into this sport, not even on a fortnightly basis, but every day. The F1 fan survey that Motorsport did in collaboration with F1 showed that. There's daily access, people want daily news, and these teams are just thriving. You look at McLaren 3 or 4 years ago, that was a papaya car, if you like. They had hardly any sponsors on it. Now they're having to rotate sponsors depending on where they are in the world because there's not enough room on the car.
Well, in November, we'll see the third edition of the Las Vegas Grand Prix. Overseeing that as CEO, as well as her job as Chief Commercial Officer, is Emily Prazer. She's risen quickly through the ranks at F1, moving over to Las Vegas ahead of the first race to head up the commercial operation under former CEO René Wilm, who we spoke to on this podcast last year. With great success in that role, she was then promoted to the top commercial role back at F1 in London, and then more recently has taken over as well as the Vegas boss from Wilm. I spoke to her over the British Grand Prix weekend. I hope you enjoy our chat. Well, Emily, it's so great of you to make the time. You're probably one of the busiest people in Formula One, a world that is full of busy people, but you are at the same time in charge of all the commercial side of Formula One, but you're also the CEO of the Las Vegas Grand Prix. Let's start with Vegas. You're going into year three. How do you see the identity of the Grand Prix now? How do you feel it's finding its place amongst all the other Grand Prix?
I think it's still very early days. Races take a relatively long time to establish themselves. And obviously, the destination in itself helps us really create the identity of the Grand Prix. We want to lean in heavily on the experiences, the entertainment, the spectacle. It's quite well documented, and we've talked about it quite a lot, how Las Vegas is truly the home of sports and entertainment with what they're building there as a destination outside of Formula One with the Raiders and the Aces, the Golden Knights, and soon to come is the A's relocating from Oakland, which is a baseball team for those that aren't familiar. We're just really grateful to be part of that kind of infrastructure and system per se, but it's just the most amazing backdrop. I mean, first and foremost, as we've all talked about and everybody knows, the actual racing has been phenomenal. The first year we had to overcompensate on the entertainment, not knowing how well the racing would go. And now I think that the racing stands up against probably the best on the calendar. Volume of overtakes, you know, we're adjusting the time of the race this year to make it easier on people. But generally speaking, I think the identity of the race is still always going to be the entertainment capital of the world with really hardcore racing.
I was going to ask you about the timings. How are you adjusting it then? Because it's caused a bit of controversy, hasn't it?
A little bit. Again, you know, when you first go to Las Vegas, they have two show times. 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. is when you go and watch the Celine Dion's and the Adele's and when the boxing happens. And if you look at the history of the entertainment proposition there, that's how it rolled. So we wanted to fit in with the kind of local ecosystem and see how it worked. But, you know, 10 p.m. was a little bit late. We want it to be the main event, so we've moved it forward to 8 p.m. on race night. Everything opens a lot earlier. We've obviously got, and everyone again knows this, the support race this year is F1 Academy, so that will take place first. And then the qualifying and race will be a lot earlier, so hopefully a little bit less challenging on the time zone changes.
What about the economic impact of the Grand Prix? Because you put some data, or rather the Las Vegas local authority put some data out around year one. It was kind of comparable. The Super Bowl was held a few months later, wasn't it? It was broadly comparable.
Yeah.
Slightly more actually than the Super Bowl in terms of the economic impact to Las Vegas. What did year two do?
Well, firstly, year one races are always going to be significant. You know, it's curiosity across the globe of people wanting to see how we would close down Las Vegas Boulevard and what the Grand Prix would bring. So the first year was unprecedented, like it was just unbelievable. Year two was slightly down, but we still exceeded $934 million of economic impact. So you can tell that the significance is still there. One of the things we took a lot of pride in improving was the relationships with the local community year round, obviously. And again, year one, you're building a racetrack. The pit building hadn't been built or constructed. And so we were very, very focused on that side of it. Going into year two, we started really understanding how we could benefit the community, not just during the race, but every day of the week. And that contributed to that number. But then for this year, and what we found is we've opened Grand Prix Plaza year round, and hopefully you've seen some of that, James.
Yep.
But what we've done is we've built an F1 drive track where we have kids karting programs and karting camps that are going to be starting in the next couple of weeks. We've got something called F1X, which we designed, which is an immersive Formula One experience, because again, North America is still somewhat uneducated on the intricacies of our sport. And so it's a much more immersive take on the F1 exhibition where you go in and you actually get to design your own Formula One car. And there's a 3D or 4D cinema, rather I should say, where you sit and you're in Nico Hülkenberg's car from 2023. So there's just a lot in it. We also have a restaurant that we've affectionately called Fool and Fork, which is a Formula One themed food, which is really fun, and opportunity to buy merchandise, simulators, etc. So just continuing to make sure that we actually have a home which isn't just a 3-day race weekend. It's this year-round influence on the destination and in North America.
And also with the emphasis, as with last year, to make it more accessible, because obviously people perceive Vegas to some extent as being a kind of for the high rollers. But I know last year you took steps to make it more accessible. It sounds like you're doing more of the same.
Yeah, I think the whole destination took steps to make it more accessible. I think as always, when major events go to a city, everybody gets super excited. After year one, we sat down collectively with all of the casinos and resorts and all those that were effectively selling to the end user. And all of the rates around the destination have come down, whether it be resorts, whether it be our proposition. Again, as I mentioned, events, Formula One races take a minute to understand who's going to show up. And once we saw the demographic of year one and year two, we just continue to evolve the product, which in turn makes it more accessible, right? We're serving the customer. We're not building something we think that works. So as we make more kind of general admission spaces and less premium hospitality spaces, it aligns with who's coming to the destination as well as catering to what each particular customer wants.
You've been blessed with two, not just good races, but really, really exciting races, particularly the year one. That must help a lot marketing the event. And the new fan survey that we've done together with you, Global Fan Survey, one of the things, my key takeaways from it was it shows that the appreciation of the racing product itself, you know, the actual race, is the focal point, both for the new fans that Formula One's attracted in the last 5-6 years, but also the long-standing fans, the more avid fans. They have that shared view on things. That must help a lot with the marketing of it.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, that's what I mentioned before. The year one, it was an unknown. We had no idea other than some simulations as to how good the racing was going to be. Now we have very competitive racing. We had Max winning the championship there last year. We feel very comfortable that the actual racetrack delivers for our customer. It gives us more to talk about. Again, you know, very, very fortunate that that was the case. As it relates to just broadly marketing, the survey was super helpful because it also gave us the understanding of how significant the Gen Z customer is to North America, to that race, but to the sport. I think what we love about Vegas is it's really been the testbed to be able to engage with that market and that audience very differently to traditional racetracks. In addition to the fact that we were the first to do some quite significant collaborations on the merchandise side, the entertainment proposition is very focused to that demographic and how we're spending our marketing dollars. We did some amazing collaborations with influencers on the likes of TikTok, which has gone more viral than some of the more traditional ways of marketing the sport just around the Las Vegas Grand Prix. So I think as we continue to be educated, again, we'll be totally nimble. But as Stefano always says, you know, act global, think local. And America has given us that kind of, well, America and Las Vegas has given us that significant opportunity to think a lot deeper about that because we're so responsible for ticket sales and the production. Whereas other races, obviously, we leave that to our very, very, very capable promoters to deliver and we show up and add value where we can.
The Las Vegas Grand Prix has always had a very strong female representation in terms of senior management. Obviously, you've been part of it from the beginning, part of the team, along with Renee Wilmer, actually built the race in the first place. You were in charge then of the commercial side. Now you're in charge of the whole thing. Talk a little bit about the importance of, you know, more diverse leadership as you see it in a male-dominated sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Vegas gave us an opportunity to build a team slightly younger than you'd expect. We really wanted to hire a lot of young, local, up-and-coming executives. Obviously, I mentioned before, there's an amazing sports background in Las Vegas, but nothing as global as Formula One. And so we wanted to take, you know, the female element, but also the younger next generation of talent. So we're super blessed. A girl called Sylvia moved over. She does a lot of work with F1 Academy and the FIA. She's head of our race operations. Sammy Rayburn, she does tons around the production and she's born and bred Las Vegas and like worked on festivals there and other amazing concerts and what have you. Lauren also worked in concerts and festivals. And so we're really proud, actually. It's not just about the female side of it. Like I say, it's about how can we train up these very capable people to take over the race one day.
Just broadening out, we talked about the survey a couple of times. I mean, one of the most impressive data points for me was 94% of all the respondents, whether they've been avid fans or the new fans, intend to still be following Formula One in 5 years' time. That's much higher than I expected it to be.
I think it was higher than all of us expected it to be. But really, it means that we have to adjust our global marketing proposition to make sure that, you know, the future decision makers, who are all of those people, continue to remain engaged and excited. And I think as we continue to build out our relationships with Lego and our relationships with Disney, which we've started teasing across the championship. You can see it on the pit step this weekend, making sure that we're doing what they need to remain engaged. I think, you know, the drivers and the teams are doing a phenomenal job of making sure that they remain top of mind as well. I think if you haven't seen the movie, you should go and see the movie.
I've seen it. I went to the London premiere.
That was, I think it's incredibly special, and I think it takes the sport to the next level. I think the soundtrack alone is something that we can reap the rewards of for many years. So, like I say, it's a lot of making sure that we continue the momentum, we convert the interest, and make sure that we are talking to these people in the right way, explaining the sport going into 2026. One of the big propositions is making sure that we explain the regulation changes and the chassis changes. You know, the racing is so good right now. And so we want to make sure that all of the next, you know, all of our fan base truly understand why we're doing things like that, with explainer videos and what have you. So the 26 campaign is super exciting. We've got to get through this year and get through Las Vegas, which I am very excited. We've got tons of big surprises, as you'd expect. And continue signing sponsors, Pepsi, etc., that really do appeal to that generation.
And then you're juggling that with also your role for Formula One as a whole. I mean, the LVMH deal, we featured the panel with them on the podcast last month or 2 months ago. I mean, what have brands like, from your perspective, companies like that bring to Formula One?
I think they give us credibility, but equally we're really helping them. You know, we are, and we've talked about it before, I think we can stand behind what Chase wanted us to do 5 years ago, which was turn every race weekend into a Super Bowl. I actually made a comment to Stefano earlier that this week in London felt like the first time we've out-activated Wimbledon. I don't know how you feel, but walking around London this week was insanity. Yeah. You had
Trafalgar Square
with McLaren, Williams, Aston Martin, ourselves. It was the first time I saw more in the 8 years I've been at Formula One, the first time I've seen more Formula One activity in central London and on Instagram and on social and everything else that I've seen ever. And so it means that not just, you know, bringing in the likes of LVMH and Pepsi and all of the above, the reality is that the teams are our biggest marketing platforms as it relates to engaging with the audience and taking over different cities. But the way that you see Lego are doing a watch party in Battersea this weekend, they've got stuff going on in Carolina. You know, LVMH are consistently helping us push boundaries, and we've got some surprises on Sunday that I won't ruin today. But, you know, the reality is we couldn't be getting to where we got to without amazing partners. But I think that the whole sport is stepping up across the ecosystem. And I think that we're pushing each other. You know, we bring in an LVMH and then you see McLaren or Aston Martin, et cetera, doing amazing deals. So I just think it's where we are and we can't take it for granted. We have to keep innovating and pushing the boundaries, but we all have leaders above us and amazing teams below us to help us get there. So very excited about what's to come.
Well, listen, thank you so much for making your time. I know you're the busiest person involved, perhaps the second busiest after Stefano, but really appreciate it.
No, thank you very much.
You're listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Channel.
So, Mark, Emily is having quite the run of it as Chief Commercial Officer of F1. As I said, sponsors pouring into the sport and revenues from the sponsorship are growing. She seems to have the Midas touch at the moment.
Yes, I think as well it's really, really key to point out that she has gone and attracted brands and brought brands into the sport that would have never really thought about it before. I think that's important. Isn't that just, you could look at the numbers, you could look at the money on offer and think it's almost shooting fish in a barrel kind of scenario, but it's not. She's going out and she's bringing in brands, she's bringing in companies that have never really considered F1 as a viable partner, and they're flourishing. We mentioned before, Emily spoke about the Lego, and you think back to Miami with the cars and Silverstone with the trophy. They're two iconic moments, really, in the history of Formula One almost, and that's from a partner that's only just come on board. So yeah, there's definitely scope for more, but Emily's done a great job in what she's already done, for sure.
It's interesting, isn't it, all the mix of it. You've got LVMH and those sort of ultra-luxury brands. You've got Doritos and, you know, all these other consumer brands. It's quite interesting how they juggle all of this. But going on to Vegas, she mentioned the economic impact down last year on 2023, down to $934 million, so just under a billion. It was slightly higher than that, wasn't it, the first year. It was higher than the Super Bowl had been when that was in Vegas over the same winter. It's not uncommon for a Grand Prix to have a lower economic impact in the second year, but they are going to need a big year this year, aren't they?
Absolutely right. It was that, you know, that we'd never seen anything of the like, really. I know we'd had races in Las Vegas before, but they were in car parks, you know, off the strip and things like that. That first year was always going to have eyeballs on it, and you know, they had their fair share of incidents with the, you know, the FP1 delay and some of the locals not particularly happy with the road closures, but they worked on that for year two. General admission tickets were worked on for year two, and I remember when we sat down with the guys from Vegas just after the second year, they said, look, year one, November, normally for Vegas, for the hotels and the companies and everything like that, 10th best month of the year, November. And they went from it being the 10th best month of the year to that first race weekend being the best weekend they'd ever had. So that just shows that step up. I know it dropped off a bit last year, was always going to. As you say, it needs to step up again, I guess, this year. You know, when we're in Canada, we were told that it's on the next 2 years on the calendar. We know it's going to be there for longer, F1. You know, they're the promoter for this race, so it can be there for as long as they want it to be. But they've ticked boxes in terms of what they needed to do. I mentioned there the ticket pricing. It was a bit of a misstep in year one. They've really addressed that moving forward. Any issues with the locals now, that it's much better. The racing is great, as Emily touched on there. It really is good fun. And it's kind of dovetailing as well with this rebrand of Vegas, if you like. Vegas trying to move on from the old casino way of life, if you like, to more sporting events. We see the Super Bowl, we see WrestleMania, we see Formula One there now. It's becoming a standard bearer. Boxing as well, of course. It's becoming a standard bearer for these global events and as a hosting platform as well, for sure.
I really noticed the prices coming down last year compared to the previous year. Hotels particularly, I got a screamingly good deal on a hotel. There is so much inventory in Las Vegas, but it was very, very reasonable. Definitely a lot more general admission tickets. And I noticed the other day they've also introduced flexible payment plans as well. So they're doing everything they can to get the travellers coming out there, the fans coming out there from all price points and all budgets. And it might sound counterintuitive, but actually I think once you got yourself there, however, there's a lot of different ways of getting to Las Vegas, routing through different cities. It's actually not a particularly expensive Grand Prix to go to, which sounds crazy when you think of it, you know, how it's positioned as a sort of premium event.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on ticketing there, which was massive in Vegas. They also Vegas is also historically a place where people buy tickets really close to the weekend. You know, they're not going to sell out early doors like they might, like you will see with a Silverstone or you see with other traditional races in more traditional markets. Vegas was always, you know, oh, we're in Vegas this weekend, there are tickets for the Grand Prix, shall we go watch it? And that's also worth taking into consideration. But James, also you spoke to, and I've spoken to as well several times, Tyler Ett from Miami, and they had the same issue really of that balancing of the ticketing. And it is, they were going into the unknown in both Miami and Vegas, weren't they? And I suppose you have to put the price point where you'd like it to be originally. But then you look at the data and you look at the figures and you think, actually, we might have had a misstep here. We need to bring in more GA tickets. And to the credit of Vegas, that's what they did then, even more this year. So you can have the experience of luxury. You can go into these thousand dollars worth of tickets and enjoy it. But also looking after, if you like, those fans with a less of a budget is key and brings in people to Vegas, as you said.
I think the important thing is to listen to the fans, recognize when you've made a mistake and correct it, which is perhaps one of the biggest differences, I think, of Formula One today compared to perhaps years past, not just ploughing on with doing the same old thing. And then maybe a Grand Prix drops off the calendar because the promoter just fails, basically. So it's interesting. Of course, F1 can't afford to fail with Vegas because they are the promoter and it's their cash that's on the line. But yeah, if I'd had more time, I think I'd like to have asked her what impact she thinks the F1 movie is going to have on their commercial revenues over the next sort of 2 to 3 years. You can see already with the box office numbers, it's Brad Pitt's strongest ever opening. One imagines its main effect will be to penetrate more deeply into the psyche of Americans, people who've heard about Formula One, not quite sure what it is, perhaps some of them being attracted to watch it more often because more of their friends are talking about it in at work or at school or in college or whatever, meaning a broader swathe of US companies are going to look at it and think, global exposure, culturally relevant, attractive to Gen Z, huge female audience who've got purchasing power. You know, where do I sign, right?
100%. We mentioned it at the top of the show, really. It's a no-brainer, really. If you're a company looking to get exposure, particularly in the USA, you can't do much better at the moment than Formula One. I suppose you look at it in a way that maybe some of them have missed the boat slightly now because the price is only going to go up to get involved in Formula One. The more we see companies wanting to get involved. But you mentioned Vegas in the film as well, and it plays a key pivotal role in the film. There's moments of the film, without giving away too much for those that still haven't gone to see it, Vegas is key to it. And so I do wonder if they will tap into the film again come November, when I'm sure it will potentially be on its streaming platforms on Apple and things like that. And there is a longevity to it, isn't there? People will discover this film months, years down the line, or still be watching it in along that time. So the film will stand the test of time, and also so will these sponsors that are now coming in, partners that are now coming on board. LVMH is a 10-year deal. You know, they're not here for one season and then they're going to disappear. And all those brands that are coming on now, they know they're getting the numbers, most importantly. They know what the numbers are. They know what the captive audience is. And now it's their job to make the most of it. And I'm going to keep harping back to Lego because Emily played a big part in that and actually spoke to Autosport Business about it in Silverstone. Those sort of activations are going to be more and more popular and more frequent as other partners come on board. We've got Disney next year. Who knows? We might see Lewis Hamilton on a Disney parade or something like that.
The latest numbers are in, as I say, from Variety on the box office takings, which now stand at $293 million currently. It cost an estimated $250 million to make for Apple and another $100 million to advertise. So it's not broken even yet, but it's certainly looking good. It hasn't even got onto the streaming yet. Breakdowns show $109 million of takings in the US and Canada, $22 million in China, and interestingly, $17 million in the UK. And there was strong word actually over the weekend in Silverstone that Apple are shaping up to put the bid in to actually have the US rights to Formula One. Numbers I'm hearing are sort of comparable to the figure that Sky is paying here in the UK. So a significant uptick, but you feel that there's a lot more for the US rights to go up to.
Yeah, exactly. And a while ago, we published on Autosport about Netflix, and Netflix were very much in discussion about that, but it has gone quiet. ESPN have the rights for the American race at the moment, but do they make the most of them? Arguably not, unless they are those punctuated American races, Monaco particularly, things like that. That ESPN got those rights for free back in the day because Liberty Media was so keen to push it onto the US market. They're not going to get it for free anymore, James, are they? We know that. The price just keeps going up and up and up. And it's going to take a big player. It's going to be a Netflix or an Apple that can even afford to pay what F1 now believe those figures are worth in terms of finances.
Well, if Emily is at the top of the commercial tree in Formula One, one man who wants to be top dog on the political side is the American Tim Mayer. He's launched his campaign to challenge Mohammed Ben Sulayem as FIA president in December's election. In announcing his candidacy, he didn't pull his punches about what he sees as the lack of professionalism of the FIA under Ben Sulayem for the last 4 years. I caught up with him to find out more. Tim, thank you so much for joining us and making the time. First of all, why have you decided to run for president of the FIA?
James, one of the things that, quote-unquote, being fired by Mohammed gave me an opportunity to do is to really think about what it was that I valued about dedicating 100 days or more of my time to the FIA as a volunteer. And, you know, it's really about service. For me, I have been so lucky in my career over the last 34 years, and I've gotten so much out of it. To be able to give back both to the sport and to the FIA generally with mobility and so on, and maybe we should explain in a minute to the audience what all that means, but just to be able to give back is incredibly important to me. And as I looked at the FIA and I looked at what was going on at the FIA, I was incredibly concerned that there was this failure of leadership, this deep, corrosive effect that was going on in the FIA. And I was worried that if this continued on for another 4 years, that this was, you know, going to be deeply problematic for motorsport in general, for the member clubs that the FIA serves, and for the fans out in the grandstands in the case of motorsport, but also road users and so on. So I just was very concerned about the state of affairs. And a number of people came to me and said, look, Tim, you are the right guy. You've had this experience. You've got the leadership skills. We would like you to do it. And those things combined, you know, plus people willing to support us financially, which, because this is an expensive process. And I have to say the support of my wife, who said, you know what, you know, you will not be satisfied standing by on the sidelines watching this. All of that combined, I decided to run.
So you said that a number of people said to you, you're the right guy for this, but what qualifies you to do this role?
Well, I've been in motorsport my entire life. James, you and I have known each other a long time, and you know sort of my backstory. My dad was one of the two founders of McLaren Racing. He was partners with Bruce back in 1963. My uncle Timmy, who I'm named after, raced. He was Bruce's first partner out on the racetrack. And so I've been in it all my life, and I've benefited from that all my life. I tried to get as far away from it as possible. I actually joined the U.S. Army. I was I was in the infantry as a private. I enlisted as a private, and then I got my commission, and I went on to be an officer in the U.S. Army. But as I went forward, I discovered that there are a lot of things about the military and motor racing that are very similar, which is that it's all about teamwork, and it's all about mitigating risk and working together. I was a TV producer for international broadcasts of IndyCar. I helped build racetracks. I organized races. I promoted races. I was in charge of logistics all over the world for Champ Car. And I ended up getting hired as the senior vice president of racing operations at Champ Car. So I did that for 8 years, and went to from there to sports car racing. And I was the chief operating officer of IMSA and the American Le Mans Series, as the American Le Mans Series was really in its upswing. Well, I had the opportunity in 2009 to reach out to Max Mosley at the FIA. I said, look, I'd like to get involved in whatever area you would let me. And he said, if you can get on a plane and fly yourself, we will put you as a GP2, GP3 steward. From there, I ended up stewarding virtually every category in the FIA. From rallycross to touring cars, from sports cars to eventually as chairman of the stewards of Formula One. And I did that I was a steward in Formula One for 15 years. And I was also involved in all the commissions and committees of the FIA. So I deeply understand the inside workings of the FIA. I've been on the Circuits Commission. I've been on the Endurance Commission. I've been on the Off-Road Commission. The important part about it is that over 34 years, I have touched, when it comes to motorsport, every element of this. And in addition, I've been on the political side. For 16 years, I sat as a deputy on the World Motorsport Council. So I've really seen the FIA from the inside out. I've seen it run well. I've seen it run poorly. And I've seen it from the side of a club, albeit a big club, And so, yeah, so the FIA is a big organization to manage, but it's one that I feel very capable of being involved with.
That's clear. So you've got like a 360 degree experience, you know, from grassroots, you know, right the way through stewarding, etc. That's clear. You're standing against the incumbent then, Mohammed Ben Sulayem. What will your message be to the voting clubs about what you would do differently?
I think it's probably helpful to explain what the voting clubs are. There are two sides to the FIA. There's the sporting side, which most of your readers and listeners will be familiar with. In the UK, it's Motorsport UK. In the US, where I come from, it's a club called the ACCUS, which is made up of NASCAR and IndyCar and all the other clubs that you would think of. Each one of those has a vote. There's also a mobility side. That in the UK, that's the RAC and the AA, for instance, and they are mobility clubs. Around the world, mobility clubs are involved in everything from providing insurance to safety to sustainability and any number of other areas for road users. So that's the whole other side of the FIA. There are 245 voting member clubs within the FIA. And so what I can offer them is two things. One is one that an area that Mohammed, in all honesty, has done reasonably well, which is to listen to those smaller member clubs around the world who are in underserved areas who need help. But the other thing that I can do is I can also do this in a professional way that means that the FIA is a trusted, respected partner around the world for members, member clubs, as well as professional motorsports, as well as the drivers, for instance, who don't want to be treated like children. So we need to be a group that listens, works together with people, and we can be more successful that way.
So things like all the hoo-ha with the swearing for Max Verstappen and all that kind of stuff, you'd be across all of that and just handle that very differently.
100%. I mean, to me, this is all about demonstrating that, in this case, Mohammed is a powerful man. That's baked into the regulations. The FIA has all the power it needs. It doesn't need to throw its weight around. We can go into the room and say, hey, guys, look, I know at the karting track, the first word of English that you learned was the F-bomb. I get that. You were all 12 at the time, and that was it. And I've actually said this in the F1 driver's meeting. But you can go in and say, hey, but we need you to be more respectful in, you know, these little blocks where it's an organized press conference, et cetera, et cetera. We don't want to take the emotion out of the sport. We don't want to take the emotion out of what you drive. I mean, I cannot imagine being in those cars at Silverstone this weekend. I mean, it must have been unbelievable all weekend long. And we need that emotion. We need to break down the carbon fiber wall, which is what I used to call it when I was a TV producer, and let that emotion out, because that's what the audience wants to see and to hear. They want to feel that these are emotional human beings doing something remarkable. So we need that to come out. And if we treat them with respect, if we have a respectful conversation about what we all need to do to help build the sport, they will respond. I've seen it personally. I know it. And I trust these drivers to do the right thing.
What's been the reaction so far? You had a press conference on Friday morning during the British Grand Prix weekend. You made your announcement there. What has been the reaction you've had, first of all, from within the FIA world, the people who actually be doing the voting in December, and also from, you know, the fans, the media, etc.? How have you read it, your reaction?
Well, the reaction, I would say, is split up into those three areas. Generally speaking, the FIA is a pretty opaque entity, and most fans don't really know much about it, other than they know that they don't like what they see and hear. So everything online that I've seen, and we've got a great team of people that's working together, everything we've seen is universally positive. Although there is still the odd person that says that I'm going to bring bias because my dad, you know, was at McLaren back in the 60s and 70s. You know, there's the odd person who didn't like a decision I made at Mexico against Max Verstappen. So, I mean, there's all that stuff. But generally speaking, it's like, no, this is refreshing to hear. We like the idea that there can be a better federation. But as I say, the FIA is opaque, and nobody ever spent money on a ticket to watch a sanctioning body do its thing. But from the teams and, you know, from the team's perspective, the driver's perspective, people have been reaching out to me and saying, look, you know, this is a steep hill to climb. You know, we thank you for at least engaging in this conversation. We like what we see. We like the openness. I think one of the biggest pieces of feedback that I've gotten is that I am not scared to answer any question. Whereas, you know, I think that's a big contrast to what we see at present. And, you know, from the voting clubs, I mean, there are a lot of clubs probably at the moment who would vote against Mohammed, no matter who ran. I think there's a lot of clubs who will vote for Mohammed, no matter who ran. But at the end of the day, I think there's a big group of clubs in the middle who are saying, okay, well, tell us more. We need to understand why we should trust you. We need to understand how you're going to help us. Because at the end of the day, this is retail politics. This is going door to door and explaining to them the value that we can bring them and what it is that we believe, you know, and it's hard for them because I come from a big club, you know, and they typically, all of these smaller clubs around the world who need the help of the FIA, you know, deeply need that help. They're mistrustful of the larger clubs because the larger clubs tend to take care of themselves. That's not why I'm here. I come from a member club. It means I've had a lot of opportunities individually. But my goal is to give back. And the way I can give back is to give to those smaller member clubs around the world, you know, where for them, it might be, you know, $5 for bus fare to bring marshals to the racetrack. I've told that story a couple of times. So, you know, for me, it's about what can we do as a federation, whether it's on the mobility side or the sports side, to really drill down and help those clubs.
And finally, Tim, you wouldn't be doing this if you didn't think you could win. And clearly you've had some messages from inside the FIA. But some people at Silverstone over the weekend were wondering if perhaps you've left it a little bit late with the FIA presidential election just 5 months away. Are you confident you've got the time to build the coalition you need? And are you confident that you'll be the only person running against Mohammed Ben Soliem in December?
Well, the second of those I don't get a vote on. If other people throw their hat in the ring, that's going to be something that we all need to talk about. I don't think it is possible for any of us to win against Mohammed if we split the vote. That's just honest, being honest. In terms of timing, it had to be now. I would love to have started 12 months ago, but it had to be now because we just had an FIA meeting in Macau 2.5 weeks ago. And in those meetings, we knew he was going to change the rules again. And by again, I mean, this is the fourth year in a row that he has changed the rules. And every time he's done it, it's just a little bit closer to centralizing power. How do I make it more difficult for other people to run against me? And that is not democracy. That is not the way to do this. In theory, he's given himself a veto over people who can run against him. I don't think it will work that way in practice, but I mean, in no democracy in the world does, you know, the incumbent have the ability to veto people. But without knowing what those rules were, we couldn't run. So we now know what the rules are. We know what the game is. We know how to play the game. Our team is deeply experienced. We've got a lot of people with a lot of experience who know these rules inside and out. We anticipated some of the changes. We didn't anticipate all of them. We're adjusting. But it had to be now.
Okay, well, we'll definitely stay across this between now and December when the election will take place. But for now, I know you're a very busy man. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you, James. So good to talk to you again.
So, Mark, he was front and centre, wasn't he, during Silverstone weekend, as was Mohamed Ben Sulayem himself, of course, when he turned up. But what are you hearing about Tim Mayer's chances? It's going to cost him around $4 to $5 million. He's got backers, as he mentions. He's got nothing to lose in some ways, as he's no longer got a role within the FIA. It's really, to me, about whether he can get a strong list together, because if he can get himself on the ballot in December, perhaps he has a chance.
Yeah, it's a slim chance, I guess, but the way he's attacked it from this first week of announcing that he's planning to run has been fantastic. I think it's worth saying as well, he's towed the line quite nicely. He's openly criticised the current president when he's felt the need to, but he hasn't really gone below the belt, if you like. There's some low-hanging fruit potentially he could have gone for and called out, but he said, during the press conference at Whittlebury Hall, he wants to keep this a clean fight. He's not going to get in the gutter and start fighting from in there. And I believe that. I think he's genuinely honest about that. And, you know, he praised MBS for some of the things he felt he'd done right. It was a very short list, I'll be honest, but he did make sure that there was some praise given out. But then he has also used phrases like, you know, he doesn't want the staff going into the offices under a reign of terror and things like that, just show that, you know, he really does think he can be the catalyst for change in terms of the FIA. And it does need someone to stand against MBS just to show that it's a democratic process. If we just had one man getting elected again without any sort of, you know, opposition, it wouldn't have been a good look for the FIA, I don't think.
Well, he says very clearly it's not linked to the Carlos Sainz Test the Waters campaign, which I think on reflection has probably not been all that helpful to Tim Mayer, because Sainz pulled out, making it look as though it's too big a mountain to climb to take on the incumbent.
Absolutely. But it's also worth factoring in here that although they made the announcement during Silverstone weekend, Tim Mayer did say, look, we've been working on this for 6 months. It's not a flash in the pan response to something. He would like to have announced it sooner, I'm sure, given that we're only 5 months out from that vote. But also he needed to understand the rules of engagement. He needed to understand what he was allowed to do. And that didn't happen until the World Motorsport Council in Macau recently. So he's been kind of hamstrung by that. Will he be hamstrung along the way by other processes? Potentially. The FIA were very quick to put out a statement, weren't they, after he'd announced, saying, you know, we don't want any of our members or employees to show support for one person or the other, which was quite telling, I thought, at the time, especially given they were happy for 36 member clubs to throw their weight behind MBS once there was a sniff that Carlos Sainz Sr. might be involved. But I also think you're right. I think, to me, the Carlos Sainz involvement muddied the waters a little bit, especially as he never looked to be far along in the process as Tim Mayer was. You know, as we mentioned there, Tim Mayer 6 months, it felt like, whereas for Carlos Sainz to be kind of still umming and ahhing about whether he wanted to do it, he clearly hadn't put in the requisite background work to then decide if he was going to do it or not, even before he then pulled the plug on it.
Well, the teams, the media, the fans, they don't have any say in this election other than advocacy, I guess, for some of them, and lobbying with the voting members of the FIA, many of whom turn up at Grand Prix and hang out there. David Richards, the Motorsport UK chairman, was kingmaker last time, swinging a block of votes behind Ben Sulayem and away from fellow Brit Graham Stoker, which contributed certainly to winning that election. Will he be the kingmaker again this time, I wonder? I mean, he appears to be behind Mayer after being shut out of the World Council for refusing to sign an NDA, among other reasons. How much sway do you think that might have?
Not as much, I don't think, this time around. I mentioned the letter there, and these 36 associations that signed it, and they are smaller clubs. They're from places, a lot of them are Central American and places like that, that you'd think, oh, I didn't even know Trinidad and Tobago had an automobile club. Well, they do. Their vote's just as valid as anyone else's. Tim Mayer, I thought, was keen to point out as well that he didn't want to change that process. Every vote should be valid in the election. He wants to service those small clubs just as MBS has. So I do think it's going to be, like you said, almost these block of votes. It's going to be these blocks that almost act as one. And it's a case of, I think Tim needs to get one or two of those big blocks behind him early in the running to show others that, you know, this is a movement, this can happen. And then the support kind of grows from there, doesn't it? He can't go into that election day or that election week, if you like, not knowing what votes he can count on, because then it could not be an embarrassment, because I think he'll do okay, but he needs to start turning people in favour of him as quickly as possible, I think.
Well, there'll be a lot of twists and turns for sure. There are 5 months until the election that takes place in the middle of December. Has Tim Mayer left it too late? Time will tell. I'm sure that we will return to this story over the coming months. That will do us, though, for today. My thanks to Emily Prazer, to Tim Mayer, and to Mark. You can read all of Mark's great work on Autosport Business. Check out all of the latest news and insights from the Grand Prix on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. And if you want to find out more about that global F1 fan survey that Mark was referencing, we recently released it, and you can download your own copy if you follow the link in the episode description notes. And do join our Fantasy League community. Check out motorsport.com for details or the episode description notes. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on X. My thanks to producer Dre and producer Matt, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow, leave us a review, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.